This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Play, a leading game developer providing player favorites to the most successful brands across the industry. With an award-winning multi-product portfolio of slots, live casino, bingo, virtual sports, and more, Pragmatic Play is powering up new possibilities of play through one single API. Visit pragmaticplay.com and discover your favorite every time.
And welcome back, and Merry Christmas, and here we are. Vested Interest Podcast is back in action. Lloyd and Benji, great to have my dear co-hosts back here today. Benji, you're enjoying your box water over in your luxury resort over in Los Angeles. How are you doing today?
Got it right here.
Bingo, bingo,
my friend. Got it here, ready to roll, and the box water is tasting great.
Not a fan of boxed water, if I'm being honest. You know, it's great to save the environment, but I find it particularly not enjoyable to drink water out of a box. But story for another day, perhaps.
Something that reminds you of drinking milk out of the box. You know, your mother told you that, Lloyd, when you were a little boy, Lloyd, and you know, it's still there somewhere. Guys, I want to start today. Actually, since we spoke last time, I've been diving headfirst in the world of daily fantasy sports, actually, because I was recommended a book by Carolina Pelk. And since we almost turned the last recording into a bit of a book club, I wanted to just mention that book, actually. I don't know if you guys have read it, but it's Dueling with Kings. It kind of tells the story about the DFS landscape from the beginning here with the loophole from Omega all the way till kind of the legal issues that we caused. But I just found it so interesting because in the first 30 minutes of listening to this book, there were some pretty well-known names that were quoted in Jeremy Levine and Chris Grove, Dustin Gaucher, and so on. I don't know, Lloyd, you read the book as well? What did you make of it?
Yeah, a long time ago. I don't remember well enough, but I know they wrote a book that covered that period.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's definitely a recommended book if you you know, if you're in the industry and you want to kind of understand the history, especially from a North American perspective, how we got to this point. You know, with the DraftKings and FanDuel of this world, the origin, quite interesting. You know, kind of exploiting this loophole that led to DFS and then obviously into sports betting from that. So we'll just start on a little book recommendation here today. But moving on from there,
just yes. So you know, Pierre, just so you know, I never read the book, but I'm waiting for the movie. So there you have it.
All right, there we go. I wonder who's going to be starring Chris Grove. You know, who can possibly play Chris Grove in that movie? We leave it for the producers. All right, guys. So I want to start today just by taking a bit of a temperature check here on the online gambling and online betting startup landscape in the North American markets. And perhaps Bendy, you know, when you look at the market today, what interesting companies are you paying attention to right now that are like up and coming? Like how do you evaluate the startup landscape at the moment?
I mean, look, you can evaluate it on a per company basis, which gets really specific on a company level, or you can evaluate it more from a category standpoint. And, you know, look, you spoke just now about kind of the DFS landscape. And I think for many people, they view the DFS landscape as a bit of a challenge right now, given some of the legislative tailwinds and headwinds that are facing it accordingly. And, you know, of course, you have the bigger players within that scope on the DFS side, but you also have some emerging up-and-comers that I still think are interesting. And, you know, in terms of other categories that are really interesting to me, you know, I think that, look, I'm a sports betting guy, but I think you look at iCasino, I think there's some interesting opportunities there, even though the rollout in the U.S. on a state-by-state basis has been a lot slower than I anticipated. I still think if you take a macro long-term viewpoint, I think there's some really interesting opportunities there. And even you look at some of these kind of B2C subscription companies that are providing content to bettors to assist them with betting decisions. I think we're seeing some interesting companies within that landscape. And look, there's a number of additional topics I can get into. I'll save some of it for Lloyd, and I'm happy to jump into specific companies as well. But therein lies a couple of themes of things that I'm looking at these days that are of interest to me.
Yeah, I think thinking about it thematically makes sense. We investing at the early stage, you invest over such long time horizons that you really need to believe in the underlying or overarching theme into which a company is playing to make a multi-year bet. One interesting trend that I've observed, and I'll try not to be too specific because we're trying to make some investments behind this trend, and you know, you'll find out when everyone else finds out. But I've noticed that over the past, and I've actually been trying to think if this is all related to a period of zero interest rate policy and ripples out therefrom or unrelated. But one thing I've noticed is that over the past 12 to 24 months, for example, let's say there are a few technologies, a few new modalities, methods of computing, methods of offering sports betting casino products to customers that I think a lot of people have gotten on board with the idea are the way of the future and the most important products or methods to secure for, you know, a competitive edge going forward. And accordingly, a number of startups popped up and said, oh, we'll deliver specialized B2B versions of, you know, whatever the new hottest, sexiest, latest and greatest is to these operators. And about, let's say, 12 months ago, almost all the operators took meetings with these B2B companies and for the most part said, OK, interesting. We agree with you, but we're going to build it ourselves. We're going to build it in-house. And now, over the last maybe 3 to 6 months, not all, but many of those large operators have been coming back to the smaller startups and saying, actually, it's a little harder than we thought, or we frankly didn't even have the opportunity to allocate the resources to get the project started in the first place, and we're no closer than we were when we talked to you a year ago, and et cetera, et cetera. And so one space I will mention I'm noticing this in, and Benji and I are both in a company in the space, is the turnkey AI-powered personalization capabilities for operators. I think every operator knows that the wave of the future is to personalize and customize each user's experience. I don't think a single operator would doubt that. The question is just whether they will build that capability in-house. And I think about a year or so ago when ChatGPT was first released, all the operators thought they would build that in-house. And it turns out that in addition to having a lot of specialized expertise, you need models trained on hundreds of millions or billions of betting transactions, and that there are just some third parties better equipped. So that's one example of a broader trend I'm noticing that I think is very interesting, where B2B companies with specialties have popped up to serve a particular niche, deliver a particular product or capability. Operators have agreed that it is important, but initially were inclined to think they would build in-house. And now, after having 6 to 9 months or 12 months to attempt to do so, are coming back and saying, we actually need a third party. And so if you can find other examples, you know, outside of the, let's say, AI-powered personalization space, and invest in those companies, you know, before they sign some of these deals and really start growing very quickly, I think there's some interesting opportunities.
It's an interesting observation, Lloyd, and it's kind of like the industry has gone full circle in a way, where at the beginning of 2020, 2021, there was this like fanatical drive towards vertical integration, right? And one company that is particularly, to your point here, Lloyd, is Kambi, the sportsbook provider, that traditionally always offered a turnkey solution, and it was kind of like a take-it-or-leave-it solution. They found great success in the beginning of the online sports betting revolution in the US, where DraftKings and RSI and many others integrated Kambi, only then to move on to their own proprietary solutions. But as you just point out, Kambi is now making a return as well. But what they have figured out is that rather than offering the full turnkey solution, they are now taking a step back and returning to the market with a more modular approach. So instead of offering the entire solution, they can help their tier one operators with more modularization approaches. For example, their AI kind of a prediction model called the Tesseract, which can help operators to predict odds and offer a much more deeper catalog. So do you think perhaps it is a combination of organizations, you know, pitching to the tier one operators, realizing that perhaps their product doesn't have perfect fit always, but they kind of take a step back and returning with a more specialized kind of approach to a more niche type product here? Is it also the operators that are, as you point out, realizing that they can't build the entire product themselves?
I think it's probably a little more related to operators facing pressure from investors to focus on gross margins, reach profitability, be incredibly disciplined. And then accordingly, what I found at G2E, I guess 2 months ago now, What I found at the most recent G2E compared to previous ones is that most of the operators had, I thought for the first time, a very specific delineation between what they wanted to buy and what they wanted to build. Whereas I feel for the last three or four G2Es, they have not really been sure, and they've been taking every call possible to see and understand what's out there so that they can do the cost-benefit analysis. And so, for example, I won't name the operator or the specific numbers, but one of the largest operators conveyed to me at G2E that they now had almost a formula internally. If it would take X years and Y dollars to build something internally, instead, they would rather spend Z dollars today to buy that functionality. And that level of specificity did not exist, as far as I can see, among any U.S. operators in their M&A strategy even a year ago. So I think it's market forces requiring operators become more disciplined and have more conviction in what's their core competency, what will they buy, what will they build.
And you know, like we're a little bit all over the map here in terms of digressing a bunch of different topics, the build versus buy, what are some of the up and coming interesting trends, and then, you know, how can a platform provider within all that, you know, migrate their overall strategy to meet the demands of today's markets, which is exactly what Cambi is doing. It made perfect sense for them, you know, in the early part of their trajectory to be a one-size-fits-all turnkey platform, take it all or leave it. And in particular, in the U.S. market, is what was required, whereas now offering some modularity is a pivot that makes perfect sense for them. So, you know, but look, coming back to what you said, Lloyd, and you know, the operators and you know, having a mandate in terms of what are the things that they want to build, what are the things they want to buy, and therefore within that, what are some of the trends in terms of startups that become interesting? And you allude to, for personalization, the thought process initially of being, yeah, we know we want that, we'll probably go ahead and build it in-house. And then a year later, obviously operators just get busy doing 101 things that they need to do to be a successful operator, and then kind of pivoting back at this GDE and saying, well, maybe that's something we should be buying as opposed to building, or outsourcing as opposed to building. Then you look at kind of, you know, some of the flip side of that might be something like, even you look at micro markets, and the, you know, micro markets is such a general term, but the evolution of in-play betting and how that's geared towards moments in the game. And of course, there's some significant players that we all know in that space, perhaps the market leader being SimpleBet, but there's a couple of others hot on their tail now going after not just the US space, but the global space with all types of markets and offerings. And there again, you know, you look at operators, and is this something they're going to continue to outsource long term, or do they have the capacity, the ability, and the wherewithal to tackle that in-house, and in what format? So, you know, that's still a trend I think that is emerging, is the evolution of betting, whether it be micro markets, whether it be the evolution of different types of parlays, and in particular same game parlays. And I think there's a number of interesting companies along the trajectory of both those particular themes and other evolving pricing metrics that will become, you know, meaningful companies in our space moving forward.
Yeah, it's interesting points, Bendy. And to rewind the tape a little bit, you talked about the iCasino market here earlier, Bendy. And actually, news that came out today is that the hero of the industry, if you will, Joseph P. Adabo of New York, the state senator over there, he has revived this iGaming bill in New York now, hoping to bring iGaming to New York and they kind of like give a push for iCasino again in the US. Do you think it's realistic? Do you think it's going to happen?
Look, I think if we take a long-term trajectory, more and more states at some point will have iGaming as opposed to not having it. And the reasons are logic and the almighty dollar. Now I get it. Like, sportsbook is an easier jump for a state than casino. And when you look at responsible gaming, you know, I think that the sports betting piece is perhaps a bit easier to control and a little bit less quote unquote addictive than the online slots component. So it'll be slower to emerge. But look, it's also known that you could achieve more handle and an easier path to profitability via iCasino as opposed to via sports betting. So even if it's less states where it is active, it becomes a very compelling opportunity. So, you know, look, sports betting still rules the roost in terms of where the interest is today, primarily from an investment standpoint. But we are seeing, you know, some emerging companies on the iCasino side, be it B2B or even on the B2C side. And, you know, even without the US, I look at a company like Betty, which is now live in Ontario. And you know, their unit economics are very compelling. And I think it's a company, one of many to keep an eye on within that vertical.
Yeah. Justin at Betty has done an amazing job. I read all of his investor updates. He's definitely one of my favorite founders in the space. I'll also just mention while you talk New York, I think we're actually probably closer to getting the green light for what will be three downstate casinos in and around the New York City area. Most likely, I feel like the front runner right now might be a casino out near City Field where the Mets play, which is also getting a new stadium where NYCFC, the soccer team, will play. And they're building, you know, a large complex that's going to have all sorts of entertainment offerings and potentially a large integrated resort. My sense is that if I had to bet, I would bet on legalized brick and mortar casino in the five boroughs of New York City before online. But more importantly, to Benji's point, I think for most states, it's a matter of when, not if, but it might be a long time until when. And it's hard to know for sure. Things have progressed quite slowly.
Lloyd, you have boots on the ground there in New York. Not to digress too much from the main topic here, but do you get the feeling that the politicians in New York are somewhat warming up to gambling in general in the state of New York? It's traditionally been a quite conservative state from that perspective, right? With kind of New Jersey taking that piece of the cake, but is the feeling a bit that New York is warming up to what's to come here?
I've gotten that feeling a bit more on the brick and mortar side, not to say it doesn't exist. Perhaps I just haven't been exposed to it on the online casino side. The brick and mortar discussion has really been in motion for many, many years now. It was long ago set that these three downstate casino licenses would come up for potential bid and auction at about this time. And I think there's just something a bit more politically palatable about having to go to sort of an entertainment destination to place a wager as opposed to being able to do it from the comfort of your mobile device. But again, I'm not a lawyer nor a lobbyist and really not close enough to all of the conversations to compare reliably the respective levels of warmth.
Cool. So yeah, thanks for that, Lloyd. So yeah, we are holding our fingers and toes and our hopes here for Joseph P. Adepu for his great efforts to bring iGaming to the state of New York. Some heroes doesn't wear a cape. Joseph Adepu, however, wears a mullet. So let's see how far that takes us. So just to bring back the conversation a little bit, I saw the other day that NVenue were able to raise some capital from the NBA. We talked about the microbetting here with the NVenue up and comer in that space. Benji, are there any other interesting investments that have been announced that you've been keeping track of in the startup landscape since we last spoke?
Yeah, look, you're right. NVenue did have that announcement with the NBA. And, you know, when you look at Lloyd's comments regarding personalization and a company within the micro betting space, such as Kiro, which combines micro markets and personalization. So, you know, alongside NVenue, I think that's an interesting one to keep an eye on as it pertains to that vertical. But yeah, look, if you're talking about specific companies and ones that I'm keeping an eye on, I just mentioned Betty, I think they're interesting. You know, I think one other theme, and we can certainly get into companies within that theme, is the entire reg tech space. You know, we've seen some mergers and acquisitions at a relatively small level, kind of the calm before the storm within that space, with GeoComply's acquisition of OneComply, and with the merger involving US Integrity and Odds on Compliance. And you look at a number of other companies that are within that space I think companies that, because they're within the reg tech space, which is a hot area when it comes to responsible gaming, when it comes to AML, I think that these are all companies that are worth keeping an eye on, whether it's Connectify and, you know, there's a whole bunch of others. So I think the reg tech space is one for sure. And then I think also, like I mentioned earlier, that, you know, I don't think we're getting that much visibility or that much discussion on the B2C side. We're getting some conversation on the B2C side, you know, regarding content portals and then their ability to generate affiliate revenue. But I think a little bit less so conversation on the subscription guys. And I think there's a couple of companies there worth noting, one that's been around a couple of years now that, you know, full disclosure, I do have an involvement with, which is OddsJam. And, you know, they're kind of viewed as the leader right now on the B2C side as it pertains to providing real strong detailed information to bettors and helping them with their betting decisions. And those guys are on a really nice trajectory. And the newcomer within that space, which I'm really keeping an eye on these days, is a company called Outlier, which some of our listeners, I assume a lot of our listeners are not familiar with, as they only launched their product back in May or June of this year, but have achieved some really nice trajectory in a very short period of time and are already achieving a very reasonable run rate and a lot of interest from the investment community as it pertains to their growth. So those would be a few companies that I would think of that I think are interesting, both in terms of themes and specific companies moving forward.
I would just add to that to mention, you know, you started this question, Pierre, saying you saw a particular announcement. And I think one of the reasons why startups like announcing funding rounds is because it gives the impression to people that there's momentum and that there is stuff happening. But that said, I've noticed a lot of changes in these tendencies. I think we've made 9 investments this year, and only one of those actually has been one of those rounds has been announced publicly. I think it's primarily for two reasons. When I talk to founders, none of it were our decision, by the way, as to whether or not to announce. It was always the founders. In many cases, especially companies in a space that's drawing increasing regulatory scrutiny, don't see any reason to be on the map more than they have to be, particularly if they're a B2B company supplying services. They just don't want to draw the attention of regulators or any other parties. And also, when you're a startup, you contract with many different service providers that you pay for stuff. And usually you get a nice discount for being a startup, or you have some sort of entry-level packaging that they plan to upsell you on your cloud compute services or your cybersecurity or your legal fees or your accounting fees or all of these different kind of things. And when you post an article that says you just raised, you know, however many millions of dollars, it makes it a lot harder to negotiate with your vendors and say that you need deals. So I would just point out that while I think it's very natural to sort of assume a direct correlation between public relations momentum and underlying company fundamentals or fundraising momentum, the reality is that the world has changed a lot since 2021, and a lot of founders, especially in highly regulated, highly scrutinized spaces, are just declining or pushing off significantly the announcements of funding rounds.
Right, that's an interesting perspective as well. However, one company that did announce their recent investment was the Canadian B2C esports-focused operator Rivalry that announced a $14 million round in order to accelerate growth, as it's mentioned in the press release. However, in the quarterly reports, I'm going to screw up the numbers a little bit now, but they're making around a $5 million loss, something around those numbers in the third quarter of 2023. And they had around $7 million, I believe, on the balance sheet. So clearly a well-needed investment that came into the company. And they did so via a convertible debentures, which is essentially the same thing as a convertible bond, Lloyd? Do you know the definitions of these?
Might as well. It's easiest. It's similar enough to a convertible note to just think of as being the same for the purpose of this discussion.
Exactly. So essentially, the investor, in this case, one of their existing investors, loaned the company $16 million. And these $60 million can either be converted into shares, or they can be repaid by the company after the loan matures with a 10% interest rate here as well attached to that loan. So that kind of leads in, segues a little bit into the next point, which is, you know, tier two operators in the United States. We saw in other news since we last did our recording that Kindred, the traditional Swedish operator, withdrew from the North American market. I did a podcast with the US MD a couple of years ago after they launched in the US, and they had quite ambitious. They were quite ambitious in the market and set out targets for kind of like high single digit market capitalization in the states they were in. Clearly, they were not able to even get close to the single digit market capitalization in the state. And after taking some heavy losses over the course of a couple of years, they now decided to withdraw from the US market. However, just to mention here, it's not exactly clear that they did so because they realized that they were not going to be able to be successful in the US market, but the company itself is being propped up to be sold at the moment. And so they are cutting headcount across the company. And it's this was one of the measures, of course, to improve the balance sheet and improve the EBITDA numbers in the short term. But long introduction short here, is it possible, you know, the ever returning question, is it possible outside of the big four, if you're a tier two operator in the US, to turn a profit? What do you need to do? What does the future hold for tier two operators? Benji, do you want to start?
Yeah, look, I mean, you touch on a few interesting themes there. And in terms of tier twos, you know, first of all, what is the definition of a tier two versus a tier three versus a tier one? I guess we're talking about anyone outside the big four or the big five as being a tier two. But, you know, when you look at these two particular companies that you start off discussing, Rivalry, who's active in Ontario, but not currently active in the US, and then Kindred. Look, I think in the context of Kindred, it was a situation where the realities didn't meet what the projections were over a five-year period when they entered this market. And, you know, the writing was somewhat on the wall for them a year ago when they pivoted out of a number of states and stayed only in the states that had casino. I think the strategy then became, because casino is much more profitable than sportsbook, let's kind of await for additional states to migrate and to legislate casino. But to Lloyd's point earlier, that's going to take a lot longer than we anticipated. And, you know, I think it got to a point where they said, we don't want to, you know, wait it out for another 2, 3, 5, 10 years to get to a point where there's enough states with casino to make sense for us to drive sportsbook for user acquisition to casino. And to your point, they're looking to be sold. You add that all up, they took the ball and went home. And by no means a reflection on that US CEO and MD that you allude to, who's a great guy and did a great job. But it's tough for tier two land. You know, you look at, I think part of it is defining for a tier two or a tier three for that matter, what success looks like. And I think that can be, you know, what success looks like and how you're differentiating and what you're bringing to the table. And I think for Rivalry, that's somewhat clear, whether they pursue a significant US component or maintain a Canadian and international component. They're differentiating in terms of the type of consumer that they're pursuing. They're doubling down, whereas a lot of folks have kind of failed as it pertains to bringing esports into the mainstream, at least thus far in the early going here. They're kind of doubling down on that strategy and targeting kind of that demographic, an emerging demographic, a demographic that perhaps views sports betting in a different way, more the gamer, so to speak. And of course, they're including all of the traditional sports betting components, but the way in which they market and the way in which they attract the customer is I think, a little bit different than what the typical tier one would be doing. So it's a strategy that we'll see if it pays off for them. Not entirely different than when you look at a company like a Better in the US that's approaching their marketing from a different standpoint in terms of their influencer strategy and leaning heavily on a low to no CAC strategy to, I guess, currently build out not just their sports betting strategy, but their entire RMG gaming strategy. But if we bring it back more specifically to legislated within sports betting, I think it's critical that a sports book define what success means to them and how they get there. And I think that there can be successful cases, perhaps not always on a national basis, but on a regional basis. And you look at a company like a BetSaracen out in Arkansas, and they're not trying to be everything to everyone across the US. They know what their backyard is. They know the audience within that backyard being Arkansas. They have some name brand recognition within as such. And that's something they're doubling down on with a level of success thus far and potentially an increased level of success moving forward. So whether you're a national operator that's taking a different approach or whether you're a regional operator that's going to be in a specific backyard or group of states where you have some sort of bricks and mortar presence and or some sort of brand identity, I think that those are strategies for a tier two that can make sense and that can achieve profitability. You're just never going to be able to compete necessarily with a DraftKings or a FanDuel, nor should you want to in some instances.
I don't really think there's much more to add than that. I would just point out quickly, one of the unique challenges of being a small regional sportsbook operator, different than being a small regional casino operator, is your exposure to, I don't know, call it geographic lumpiness in your betting handle. If you are only live in Arizona, that's the only jurisdiction you're live in, and the Arizona Cardinals are in the Super Bowl or the Arizona Diamondbacks are in the World Series, your entire user base is only going to be betting on one side of that market. And on the one hand, of course, you can move the lines a bit as you normally would, but you kind of have to keep them in line with the broader national markets, or at least you have to keep them, you know, not too far askew, because then you open yourself up to exploitation and arbitrage opportunities. So that is just something unique that some of the smaller regionals deal with. The common theme to me in everything that Benji said is pretty much sums up what my answer is going to be, which is that you need to be doing something different. And you need to be uniquely positioned to do that thing. Benji mentioned a number of companies that are doing something very different and specific, and whose management teams are uniquely positioned to achieve whatever that particular value proposition is. And success isn't even guaranteed for them. So if you are either not differentiated or not uniquely positioned to deliver on your value proposition, and you're a tier two or tier three operator, certainly that seems like a recipe for at least a lack of success, considering that there are a number of truly differentiated, truly uniquely positioned challenger brands out there.
And I'll add
speaking
a,
about
I'll
arbitrage.
Add a couple. Go ahead. Sorry, Pierre, I'll add a couple of comments on top of that. And you know, you look at a company like a Prime Sports in Ohio, which is kind of taking a specific approach. And you know, we're not seeing massive numbers there yet, but they're only a month or two into this, and we're seeing some traction based on the approach that they're taking. So I think there is an opportunity to kind of carve things out if you have, to Lloyd's point, if you're clear on what your differentiator is and how you're going about doing it. But you know, the other reality is that, you know, within the U.S. in particular, sportsbook is a challenge. Like the unit economics. I love the industry. I love the space. I love the U.S. market. You know, my background's a bit more B2B. I love real money gaming and all of the opportunities with it. But when you talk about sports betting specifically and all of the legislative challenges on a state-by-state basis that come with it, it's a challenging business. It's challenging to run on a state-by-state basis with the different tax regimes and the inability to pool liquidity. It's real difficult for some of these exchanges getting out of the gates when they're working on a state-by-state basis. You know, the unit economics in sportsbook are very challenging. And, you know, those realities are things that have come to pass and that we've seen for some of the tier twos that are no longer with us. So it really does require that if you're going to come into the space as a tier two, that you understand those unit economics, that you understand those state-by-state challenges, and that you embrace the reality of it if you're going to pursue legislated sports betting in the U.S. And you better have a real concrete plan as to how you're going to win and what winning means for you.
Right. And I think Kindred is a good example here of perhaps a tier two operator that entered the market with a bit too much confidence, let's say, because the numbers are there to see in the quarterly report. And we can see in Q3 2023 that the Kindred spend almost as much in marketing as the entire GGR. And not only that, but they also spent as much money in cost of sales. So you would imagine this is affiliate related costs mostly. As they also had in gross gaming revenue. So really difficult to make the financials work unless you hone in perhaps on a niche in the market. Another good example perhaps is I spoke to the CEO of Resorts Digital, not to be confused with Resorts World, but Resorts Digital is a smaller casino resource in New Jersey. And they have a lot of legacy in that state with the casino being established there and the brand being established for many, many years. And many of their demographic, which tends to be kind of older returning customers that've known the brand for many years, when they were converted into online, their natural place to go was resorts, just like they go when they go in person as well. And at Andrews, he talked about, you know, not really being that interested in becoming bigger than what they are, not really being that interested in launching in other states or trying to kind of recreate the success they've had in New Jersey. They are zoned in. They know where they are strong. They know where they have brand equity, and they have been successful doing so, albeit, you know, on a much smaller scale. So I thought that was a interesting example as well of someone who managed to kind of find their place in the industry over in North America. Not to digress too much, but Lloyd, you mentioned you know, the risky nature of being a sportsbook in a single state, with the sport calendar being as it is, and it just reminded me of a bit of a funny story I wanted to tell you guys when it comes to kind of tilted arbitrage and stuff like that. That there's a guy called Matthew Shaddick, and in the US you don't have political betting. It's not legal in the US, but over in Europe, political betting is quite popular. And Matti Shadi talks about two times in the sports betting history with an incredible like arbitrage being had and tilting towards one direction rather than the other. One of those examples was when Conor McGregor fought Floyd Mayweather, and everyone was betting on Conor McGregor to win. There was like an incredible overlay on the side of Conor McGregor that the sports bet, and this was one of the biggest, you know, betting events of the year, that the sports bet were really, you know, crossing all the fingers and toes, you know. But however, in that case, it was quite clear who was going to win. Floyd Mayweather won there, of course. But the second story is a political story. So if we rewind the tape back to 2020, no sports betting activity, obviously pandemic, lockdowns, so on and so forth. What happened with that year? There was the presidential race, right? Trump versus Biden. This became the biggest single sports betting event of the entire year in Europe. The odds for Joe Biden to win, according to all the polls, were something like 90%, you know, like 9 out of 10 times Joe Biden was going to win, according to the polls. However, if you were to place a sports bet, the odds were closer to something like 6 out of 10, or like 60%, or, you know, 1.4 odds, something along those lines. And the reason for that, again, was that like 85% of all the bets made in the single biggest sports betting event of the year was placed on Trump. I remember in the morning here in European time, when the election was being counted, if you remember, at first the election was tilting towards Trump to win. And in the morning we woke up here in Europe, and I had a prep call with some of the CEOs of the some of the operators here in Europe. They woke up, and I've never seen them more dreadful than I saw them in that call, because they were going to take such a big loss by Donald Trump winning the presidential election that it was going to ruin their entire quarter. Only to then, of course, turn around and Biden won. So I can say that the iGaming industry definitely, or the sports betting industry definitely, were on the side of Biden, not for political reasons, but for their own life. It was quite interesting, I thought, how things can tilt one way or the other.
My only comment there, Pierre, is did Biden win, or are they still counting those votes? Are they still recounting them?
I'll leave that up to my American friends to think about those very deep and difficult questions. Good luck with that. Speaking of that, it was an interesting presidential debate yesterday also. Nonetheless, guys, let's move on for that. We are not the All In podcast here. We steer away from politics as much as we can. Next topic is another interesting question that I think a lot about as a startup, and, you know, having gone through a couple of investment rounds myself. You know, step one when raising capital is obviously you create your pitch deck. We talked about that in the in one of the previous episodes. How do you create the great pitch decks? You know, as an investor, what do you look for in these pitch decks? But let's say that you create a great pitch deck. Fantastic. You raise some interest from investors. Lloyd and Benji is now interested to take that first call. I'm interested to know from you guys as well, how do you take this interest that you have now created as an entrepreneur, and how do you sail it all the way into securing the investment? Like, from your perspective, how do you navigate this process as an entrepreneur, from interest to investment? And what are the common mistakes that you see in investors when they go from step one to step two, let's say? Lloyd, if we start with you.
I think the best way to inspire confidence is to actually be confident yourself. Sometimes that comes from having a whole bunch of other investors lined up, so that you truly are almost indifferent to the particular call you are having, and that, you know, implicitly gives you, I think, this confidence or swagger that then provides the person you're talking to with some level of confidence. Obviously, though, your whole question was, how do you even get any investors, you know, to the point that they're committed in the first place? So that's obviously not a helpful answer. I think it stems from, ideally, having a really good underlying story to tell, preferably with metrics to back it up. If your numbers tell a good enough story, you have no reason to not be, you know, entirely confident. And then the question becomes, okay, if you don't have numbers that sell themselves, how do you instill confidence? And I think it comes down to just having an incredible level of clarity as to your vision and expertise. And when you're asked a question, showing that you have obviously thought about that question in great detail and put a deep level of thought into all the decision-making that you're deploying into the company. Justin Park, who runs Betty, which Benji talked about, I think probably does this as well as any founder I come across. When he pitches you, I mean, he shows you these blog posts and these memos that he wrote 5 years ago about how he wanted to design the company. And then he shows you the website today, and it's like the sketches from 5 years ago are exactly how it's all diagrammed. And so then when he tells me, and by the way, here's the diagrams that I drew up today for how I think things will be 5 years from now, I have nothing but reason to believe that he's going to pull those things off, because he just gave me an entire data room of setting out exact plans and succeeding in executing on those plans. And that was just one example. I think there are probably many types of examples of similar behavior, but that is the kind of thing that inspires confidence, where every question, every exchange, it is just clear to the investor that you are so on top of it. You have thought through it so well that, I mean this half jokingly, like I almost feel stupid for having asked you the question, because it clearly was a waste of my breath, because you have thought of that question and every answer to it and permutation thereof so thoroughly. And you have so much confidence and capability in not only answering that question, but like doing the stuff that the question pertains to, that I know I'm going to give you my money. And even if I fall asleep for 10 years and wake up, you will have made great decisions and steered the company successfully along the way. So I think that's the sense you're trying to give. And then totally separately from all of that capability stuff, and Benji mentions this all the time, and it's especially relevant to non-VC investors, like angel investors, showing the investor that you're someone that they would want to spend some time with outside of work and grab a beer with and genuinely enjoy, you know, spending time with and getting to know and building a business with over a long term. Because especially if you're an angel investor who could stick that 100K check in a 5% interest-bearing, liquid, risk-free asset, you're going to want to make investments that also bring some happiness, you know, to your life. And that tends to happen when you work alongside founders who are a pleasure to work with and, you know, are open to coaching, but also resolute in their vision for the future.
Yeah, I got to say, Pierre, I kind of hate following Lloyd on this type of a question. And the reason being is he's become such a evolved into such a polished venture capitalist that he just really nails the specifics of this type of a question and exactly what an investor is looking for, be it a VC or other, from a founder. But I will add a couple of components. Like, it doesn't start with the pitch deck. It doesn't start with to me, it starts before that. And I think that it's never too early to start building those relationships with all components of whoever it is you're going to be doing business with. And in this case, if you're going to be starting a business potentially in which you're going to need to raise capital, the time to start building those relationships with investors and venture capitalists is potentially even before you need to go to them and raise capital. You can come to them and start discussing, here's where my ideas are, begin networking and begin discussing your ideas and begin getting some feedback from the VC community and from individuals who will give you 10 minutes of their time as to what it is that they're looking for. And with each conversation you have with someone who's either an angel investor or a VC themselves, or maybe is lower level working within a VC firm that will give you some time, you begin to form a framework of what it is that they're looking for. And you begin to build some relationships such that as you began formulating and finalizing your plan and evolving that into a pitch deck and going out to actually raise capital when you get beyond the point that it makes sense to be bootstrapping, that you're not starting from ground zero, but starting from something above ground zero. So I think that there's a lot that can be done well in advance that builds the relationship. And I think that relationships do instill confidence. And, you know, I think all that's part of the process. And in addition to being buttoned up and having metrics that you can show an investor that speak for themselves, being able to start from below ground zero when you're at that point will just really work more and more in your favor as being viewed as somebody who we should be confident in, because you were thinking about this in the case that you allude to, Lloyd, with Justin Park. He began thinking of this 5 years ago and is showing you how he began thinking of it 5 years ago and somewhere along the line had conversations with
with you know, maybe not with you, but with other investors about where this thought process was and then how to evolve it. So I think that all that really plays into it. And I think that that's something that, you know, and then when you actually are having these conversations with VCs and or angels and or private equity groups, when you get to your Series Bs, showing that you understand their viewpoint, I think becomes critical in terms of instilling confidence. It's not really about you, and it's not really just about your journey. Maybe it is for you, but it's not for that VC. It's not for that investor. And I think that you need to show them in the way that you articulate yourself, in the way that you present the opportunity, in the way that you articulate it both verbally as well as in your written documentation, that you understand who they are, you understand what their objectives are, and maybe you don't from day one, because not every VC is built equally in terms of what their expectations are and in terms of what types of investments fit the mold of what they're trying to achieve. So I think part of that is doing your research on those venture capitalists and those angel investors prior to having the conversation, or as part of the reach out, having a two-way conversation that shows that you're astute enough to be asking the right questions to ascertain if they would be the right fit for you and vice versa. And not just making it about, I need your money, but making it about, is this a relationship that can be really mutually beneficial for both parties? So I think that those are a couple of soft dynamics, maybe not as specific as what Lloyd's alluding to, that will play into instilling confidence with someone like Lloyd when you pitch them.
Benji's so spot on. And I would just to add, you know, what I think is implicit in all of Benji's comments that is so true is so much of it is about all these little things. The pace you respond at, the voice you use when you respond, if someone asks for something, you know, the quality of the formatting and the thoughtfulness you put into it. As you're going back and forth with someone, you really start to get a feel for them. And I think we've said many times on this show that the earlier you are, the more an investor is making a bet on a person and not a relationship. And I think one of the best conclusions of what Benji put quite well is that you don't need to have a product or a pitch deck to build a relationship. And if building a relationship is the most important facet of, in many cases, successfully raising funding, then certainly there's no reason to wait until you have a deck or until you have a funding need in hand. Not to mention that it is always much easier to get a call and reflect well upon yourself when you are not desperate for something as compared to when you are, and always better to be in a position of strength. So could not agree more with all that advice.
You speak about these two points very eloquently, Lloyd and Benji, here, how important it is for the founder to make a good impression. And I just want to mention when Yolo Group, which is a 650 million euro venture capital fund, they got this question during a conference, you know, what do you look for in a founder? And they just answered it in a four-word answer, which was, don't be a dickhead. and I suppose that's what we are getting at here. Bendy,
I think Yolo looks for a little bit more than that, even to be fair to them. I think they have a slightly higher bar when they deploy their capital. They're very smart investors, so just to be fair.
Yeah, they are indeed very, very smart investors, but they do also have this as the number one policy, the not be a dickhead policy. It starts there, perhaps, and then you go from there.
But Bendy, something I think... A necessary condition, but not a sufficient one, absolutely. I'm sorry, continue.
Good point. Bendy, so something I took with me that is interesting for me in this conversation is the fact that you talk about, you know, it's not only about you as the founder and your project and your vision and what you try to accomplish. It is also about understanding the VC and what they are trying to accomplish and how they view success in this relationship. It's quite interesting because I would assume that most people that come to you guys don't really see it from that perspective. They would probably be more interested in talking about their own product. So I want to ask you, how often do you get potential investment objects that actually do ask those questions back? What do you see as success, and what are you looking for in this investment, and try to understand you as they go along in this pitch? Because as you point out, it's not one pitch for all investors. It is obviously you need to tailor your pitch to the investor you are speaking to.
What I would say go ahead, Benji.
Yeah, I guess I'll jump in first here, Lloyd. Look, I don't have a mathematical number in terms of what percentage, other than to say the smart ones do. It would be more than you think that come to me and have a thoughtful approach, as opposed to just, hey, I need money. Can you help me? Who can you introduce me to that has, you know, wants to write $100,000 checks because we're raising some seed or pre-seed capital? I think the ones that are smart You know, Lloyd recently, you know, introduced me to a founder on the within the daily fantasy space that has kind of a unique startup. And this was a founder who, when I had conversations with him, took that exact approach. And it wasn't just about, you know, he'd already raised some capital in fairness. It wasn't just about, hey, I need your check, because I don't think he does need my check. It was more about, you know, if you were to provide a check, you know, in what other ways can you work with us? How would you be able to help us on our journey? How synergistic am I as a founder in terms of the way that you view the industry? And I think that the ones that are astute and that are, you know, listening to not necessarily this podcast, but other podcasts about raising capital and about how to be the best founder you can be, are in tune with the importance of not just having capital, but having a group of investors and advisors alongside them that are going to row the rowboat in the same direction with them and make it kind of a collective and a collaborative journey.
Yeah, great points. I think I would only add that, you know, an important thing, Pierre, to remember is just the numbers that you're up against. So we'll look at 1,000 pitch decks to make 10 investments. Across 1,000 pitch decks, if you ask me, are there 10 companies that did anything? Insert your favorite tactic there. The answer is yes, which means that if there's some thing that I like to see founders do, you are always up against a number of companies I'm seeing that I could invest in and exclusively invest in. I could make my entire fund companies that only have pretty much any characteristic I wanted. And if you are not one of those companies that has one of those characteristics, just because of the sheer numbers, and that's not specific to us. You know, most VCs are seeing hundreds, thousands of decks. And to Benji's point, yeah, a lot more than you think, you know, especially in the US where there's, you know, maybe an entrepreneurial culture that causes kids from even a younger age to be studying some of this stuff. But even elsewhere, the two things that stick out are, I think at the beginning of conversations, even, you know, really strong founders will almost make you pitch them. They will ask you questions about your process. How long does it take? Is there an investment committee? What are your check sizes? Do you do follow-on checks? All these questions like that, they really take control. And then even more specifically, what, you know, I think, you know, some founders will do is they'll understand how VCs do math. And they'll do that math for the VC on a slide. And they'll say, hey, if you invest $2 million in us today, here's how much you'll own. You probably project this amount of dilution over this much period. By the end of 5 years, we'll sell for this much. Here's how much your portion will be. We know your fund size is this much. Therefore, you'll be able to advertise to your LPs a return of such and such amount. You know, really, really going through that effort. I've seen founders who know that VCs are going to have to put together an investment memo for their investment committee. And I've seen founders write a 16-page memo from the voice of the VC that they were trying to pitch, because they know that that VC would otherwise have to spend 10 hours putting together that same kind of memo and going to their investment committee. And so there are, you know, more than enough companies for any VC to invest in that are doing all these kind of things regularly that you don't want to put yourself at a disadvantage, you know, by declining or neglecting, I think, to take some of those tactics.
Yeah, so to summarize this, I mean, as you point out, Lloyd, for every 100 pitch decks you you look at, you make one investment. And out of those 100 companies that pitch to you, someone is going to have an incredible pitch deck. Someone is going to have an incredible background as a founder, or they're going to be a great personality. Someone is going to do the numbers correctly. Someone is going to do the background check on you as an investor. And so you don't want to be the founder who is kind of like playing it safe and be conservative and kind of be in the middle of that field. Like, you need to stand out if you're going to have a chance to become that one out of 100, essentially. You need to do your job, you know?
Absolutely. If you're going to build a company from scratch into a successful business amidst a ton of competition and multi-billion-dollar companies trying to stand in the way, I would say that also is the case. You'll need to stand out and you'll need to be different. And a lot of these things end up kind of being filters for that. You know, we talked a couple of episodes ago about needing, you know, a lot of VCs liking to get a warm intro as a way into them. And I think someone commented somewhere on YouTube or on one of the, you know, videos of our podcast somewhere. And it's always
don't check the comments, Lloyd. It's so much hate out there. You know,
trust me,
all the hundreds of comments that we're getting.
and one of the comments somewhere, which comes up often when a VC says they like warm intros, was someone saying like, well, how is that fair, you know, to all the people who didn't go to Stanford or Harvard and aren't living in New York or San Francisco? And actually, Mark Andreessen got this question recently on stage at some conference even, and he answered, you know, and I think what is exactly what is intended, which is that the idea of preferring warm intros is that as a founder, networking your way to an investor halfway across the world is the easiest thing you will have to do to succeed and build a $100 million or billion-dollar business. And that if you lack the resourcefulness and the tactfulness to network your way to an investor, you almost certainly will lack the resourcefulness and the tenacity to network your way to all the way more difficult things you will need. And so I think there's a similar thing here where some of these, you know, things that we're mentioning, they end up acting as sort of these natural filtering mechanisms where unless you truly are dedicating your life to your business, you know, maybe you won't pass a particular filtering mechanism that an investor has. And that's good for them. You know, they only want founders who are dedicating their life to their business or whatever it is. So that's the other thing I would encourage founders to think about is if you were a VC and you had more pitch decks coming in than you could possibly look at, and you had to develop a set of signals or filters that you would use to try to make certain decisions more quickly, you know, what would those be? And to just put out a totally different angle that I heard, I think this is a Warren Buffett one, actually. I heard that Warren Buffett used to go to classes and say to young entrepreneurs, look around the class, think about your friends, think about people you know or other founders you know, and think about whose earnings of your friends you would want to own 10% of going forward. And whatever traits those people exhibit, adopt those traits and be like those people and adopt those, because that is how you instill in others the same type of confidence that those people instilled in you.
Brilliant. I want to be like my friends Lloyd and Benji. I'm gonna take up you guys' characteristics here as we go forward. Thank you very much for that. As a follow on to this point, let's flip the coin a little bit and talk about then what do actually the VCs look for in regards to their own return when they invest into various businesses. Obviously, not all VCs are the same, but the kind of category investment type that the VC is has some similar traits between the VCs. So, Lloyd, just starting off with you, perhaps looking from your own perspective, you know, when you look for investment, what kind of returns do you look for in general? And on a more broader question, in general, what type of returns are VCs looking for?
It's a good question because I've seen a lot of founders get frustrated that they feel like they talk to a VC who really loves their business and ends up declining to invest, and they take it as some sort of indictment of their business. And the reality is that I see a lot of great businesses with great founders all the time, and I just can't invest because I have a certain threshold for the type of returns that I'm trying to generate that my investors are expecting. And so I do think it's worthwhile understanding. And I think the best way to understand is to understand how VCs make money. Most people, I'd say in the US, working in venture capital, at least in the first 5 or 10 years of their careers, are making less guaranteed cash salary than they could at another job of an equal level of seniority somewhere else on Wall Street. That is almost universally the case. Now, maybe they're taking that pay cut because VC is more creative and more entrepreneurial and a better work-life balance and all that. But financially, they do it because in addition to getting a salary, you usually get a percentage of carry, which is short for carried interest. And that's a term. It comes from, I think, like the 1400s. The origins of the venture capital industry was financing shipping voyages, and you would get an interest in the cargo that was being carried for funding the shipping voyage. You would get carried interest, and now somehow that term got applied. And typically carried interest is in the amount of 20%, which means once you give your investors back their money, you get to keep 20% of the rest. So if you have a $100 million fund and you turn it into $200 million, that's $100 million in profits. You get to keep 20% as the VC. That's $20 million. We had Roger Ehrenberg on last episode, I think it was, and I'm pretty sure his returns are public. I don't know if the fund sizes are, but Roger's second fund returned over 20x to his investors, which means if he had a $100 million fund, 20x would be $2 billion in returns. That would be $1.9 billion in profits. 20% of that is $380 million, which means Roger and his one or two other colleagues would have split, if it was a $100 million fund, him and, you know, a couple of other guys would have split a $380 million payout. And so you can see very quickly that these numbers get very large and they get very enticing. But when you inspect more closely, imagine you're a $100 million fund. You write 20 checks, $5 million each. Let's say the first check you write, you know, you invest five at a $50 million valuation. You own 10% of the company. Most likely by the exit, you'll get diluted in half. You'll own 5% of the company. Let's say you really hit a grand slam. You invest at a $50 million valuation in a company that gets sold for $2 billion. It's as good of an outcome as a VC could hope for. Most VCs will never hit such an outcome. You own 5% of a $2 billion company at exit. That's $100 million. But that's the size of your fund, and you have to repay all your investors their money before you earn any carry. So you could make an investment. You could put $5 million into a Series A at a $50 million valuation, sell that business for $2 billion, and still not be earning your carry because you've only now sort of broken even on the fund. And the reality is that most deals go to zero or return less capital that was put into them. And the deals that succeed, they take 10 years to succeed. So when you factor all of that in, you start to understand why if you're a venture capital associate or a partner at a firm and you're foregoing significant cash compensation every year for the hope of a big payout when your portfolio starts to get liquidated, you're really incentivized to shoot for the moon and make bets that if successful will have multi-billion dollar exits. So I don't have a specific number for you in terms of what percent or multiple returns we look for. And I don't think any VC really has a specific or a concrete numerical threshold, but they all tend to invest with this mentality and with a sort of rule of thumb that you make each investment as if that one investment needs to return the size of your entire fund. As if that one investment, if successful, will allow the rest of your investments to go to zero and still break even. And the quick back of the envelope math would be if someone's making 20 investments, you need to 20x the money they gave you, you know, for that to be the case. And again, no specific numbers, but hopefully that's at least helpful in understanding the background and the kind of orders of magnitude of returns that VCs are expecting.
Bendy, I want to ask you as well, you know, as a private equity investor, as an angel investor, what's the differences that you expect as an angel investor, as a single angel investor without having LPs to speak to and so on, when it comes to your investment philosophy in comparison to a traditional VC?
So let's get to me in a minute. Let me first comment on what Lloyd says, because I typically agree with 100% of Lloyd's commentary. And here there's some parts that I might not entirely agree with, which I'm excited about, actually. So Lloyd, I'll kind of ask you this, right? Like, I understand the mentality that an investment, when you make an investment, you make it with the thought process that investment has the ability to return your fund. But is that always the case? It wouldn't always be the case for every VC. But would it even always be the case for you? Obviously, a B2C company, by definition, in our space at least, likely has a larger TAM opportunity than a B2B company. But might you not consider an investment in a B2B company with a specific founder that you have a lot of confidence in, that you recognize doesn't have the ability to be a 50x or even a 30x return, but that can achieve a reasonable multiple of some sort based on that individual's track record, perhaps even a second-time founder or a third-time founder over a shorter period of time where you believe, all right, well, we could do this one. It might not be our home run that returns the fund, but we could still get involved in this particular company. We see it as a road to perhaps a relatively quick 3 or 4x, and it'll just be a positive development within our fund as opposed to returning the fund. Is that not part of the mindset of VCs in general, or even of yourself, or am I mistaken in that?
Well, so absolutely. First of all, one thing I would take slight objection to is I definitely agree in 2021, especially, there was a ton of deals that got done under the premise of this will be a quick 2-year, 3 to 4x return. And I think given where capital markets have gone, especially institutional investors have abandoned the idea of truly betting on, you know, a quick 3 to 4x, because those just don't exist so frequently and capital markets are much tighter than they were. But to your broader point, absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that has always been funny to me about that VC rule of thumb I described is that if you take it a few steps further, if your goal is to make investments that will return the size of your entire fund, then in theory, for any given investment, if you think the outcome will be larger, you invest less. And if you think the outcome will be smaller, you invest more because you need to own a higher percentage of a smaller company for that outcome to return the size of your entire fund. Now, that is very antithetical to the sports betting world, where with the Kelly criterion and similar, you bet in proportion to your edge. Whereas what the rule of thumb I describe seems to be saying is that you should actually do the opposite. So what I try to do, and what I hope and think others should do, but not all do, is some sort of combination of a Kelly criteria with a, you know, each company returning the fund rule of thumb. And I think somewhere in the middle is the correct answer. But I absolutely agree that there is a flaw in purely following that rule of thumb. And in particular, because I think you miss some of the opportunities that Benji, you know, is referring to. And then I'll just comment specifically, I think in our space, the B2C companies are where almost all of the largest outcomes will be on an absolute basis, but that an overwhelmingly large proportion of the best risk-adjusted returns that I see are in the B2B space.
Yeah,
isn't it also
go ahead, Pierre. You go ahead.
Isn't it also true that most VC funds get the returns from like one slam dunk? Like that's generally where the return comes from. I think it's Peter Thiel who always talks about that. Like you should never invest in a company that can't strive for a monopoly. Maybe that's a bit too extreme in the way of thinking as a potential investment. But isn't it also true that it's mostly from the return comes very top heavy in any given VC fund?
So in the ones that you've heard about, because they've done well, yes, there is, you know, Roger Ehrenberg had the Trade Desk and Peter Thiel had Facebook. But what ends up being the case is that if you do not have a 1,000x return in your fund, then each 2 or 3x that you have ends up being, you know, really important to at least hopefully paying your investors back, if not, you know, hopefully giving them what they would earn at a risk-free rate. And so that's another thing that is always tricky. On the one hand, you want to invest just like you want to run your company as if things will succeed. And in that regard, yeah, you know, probably every one of the most successful of the 50 or 100 most successful VC firms in history have had a, you know, single company that drove an outsized portion of the returns. But that is, I think, an approach that doesn't appreciate some of the emotions of it. Every investor that I raise money from is someone who I have a deep relationship with and really, really care about, at the very least, returning every dollar they gave me plus some basic level of interest. And again, if you fail to generate a 1,000x return in your portfolio, and by the way, if only one out of 1,000 companies return 1,000x and you have 20 companies in portfolio, most likely you will not have one. If you really, really care about, you know, making your investors whole and making sure that they get paid back, there's a great case to be made for having some lower risk 2, 3, 4x returns in the portfolio. I think the answer is no one agrees on this universally, and you can find endless blog posts and debate about portfolio construction is the key word that if you look up, you'll find all this stuff on.
Right. Just a short question as well, Lloyd. I mean, how many companies out of 10 companies that you invest in do you expect to get the return from in the first place? I mean, obviously this varies wildly, but I wouldn't imagine that there would be that many of the 10 that you invest in that actually ends up returning.
Yeah, it ends up just being an assumption, which is the trouble. You're right. The basic power law would say that out of 10 companies, 8 will go to 0, 1 will do okay, maybe you'll double your money, and then 1 will hopefully be a 5, 10, 50, 100x. But those are aggregated over thousands and thousands of portfolios and thousands of startups. The reality is any given fund will have too small of a sample size for the law of large numbers to really kick in.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just getting to the point. Like, if that is the true in the law of large numbers, you know, you can expect then as a VC that you would any given investment that you look at, you would want at least a 10x return on that investment. Or do you actually specifically take on investments that will potentially return 2 or 3x, even despite that you're working against the odds in that regard?
Yeah, don't want to get bogged down into any numbers that are too specific here. I think a lot of it comes down to a deal-by-deal basis. If you're doing a seed round and it's the first institutional money in and there's a ton of risk factors still remaining, you definitely want to see a path to at least a 10x return to compensate you for the risk. If you're investing in a business that's been profitable for 5 years and, you know, is generating millions of dollars in EBITDA and has already received 5 M&A offers, certainly you can afford to take you know, a different type of risk and underwrite, you know, to a lower return. So it's all about risk adjusted return at the end of the day.
Fair enough. Benji, I'm curious to jump over it to you now, just going back to the original question here. As an angel investor, how do you think about multiples and how do you think about return when you speak to potential investment objects? Do you have a specific formula that you follow or do you look at every opportunity as an individual opportunity?
Yeah, no, I'll definitely comment in regards to my perspective as an angel investor, which differs from a VC. It's just one comment related to all this is that we should have brought Roger Ehrenberg back for this particular podcast for this topic. I mean, if he's getting 20 X's for his investors, I'd like to hear a little bit more from him on the secret sauce on that. But putting that aside, look, for me, it really is a bit of a different mentality and a different approach because I'm not representing the interest of LPs. I'm representing the interest strictly of Benji Cherniak. And there's multiple objectives when I'm making an investment. And one of them, of course, is maximizing ROI. You know, I have a dollar to invest. It can be invested anywhere I want to invest it. If I'm going to invest it into the iGaming ecosystem at the pre-seed, seed, or series A level, which is typically where I'm making my investments, then obviously I want to be in a situation where ideally I can maximize the return on a given investment. But that really isn't my only criteria, you know, because in many instances, alongside the check that I'm writing, I'm getting involved in some capacity, be it advisory, board, or other, in assisting the entrepreneur in that journey. So it also becomes a question of who are the entrepreneurs that I feel I can really help them in terms of moving the needle. It's quite rare that I'll make a 100% passive investment. Usually when I'm bringing capital, and this would be the case with Lloyd as a VC, who's a very proactive VC, but for me as an angel, you know, typically when I'm writing a check into a company, particularly within the sports betting ecosystem, just having years of experience within that, if it's, a first-time founder who's still learning the space, there's a lot of areas where I can add some value. And it's assessing where can I add maximum value? Where is it an entrepreneur who I believe is somebody that is going to win and that I can help win and that I want to help win and that I'll enjoy helping win? And it's not just about, for me, 100% maximizing ROI. That might be the number one criteria, but ensuring that I'm working alongside entrepreneurs in companies that in spaces that interest me and companies that interest me with management teams that I really feel aligned with. Those things are in some cases equally important to me. And it becomes kind of a part hand in hand of winning, of being able to achieve an ROI, is being able to work with entrepreneurs who I think are entrepreneurs that I feel aligned with. So I think those are critical pieces for me as well.
Right, Benny. So for you, it's not only about looking at the ROI and the return of investment on your object. It's perhaps also for you personally to throw yourself in the fray and to continue to work with exciting companies and spend your time getting to know interesting people and interesting businesses and learn from that and so on.
Yes. And the but within that is, to Lloyd's point earlier, you know, he's investing in one of every 1,000 decks that makes his way. I don't get quite as many decks, or I don't expose myself to quite as many decks as Lloyd does. But there's so many companies out there that we're at a point now where you know, there's so much opportunity for investment and so many fantastic entrepreneurs with fantastic ideas that there are a number of companies out there where I feel as an investor I can achieve both a maximum ROI as well as all of the soft pieces that would make this a really compelling journey to be a part of.
What I'll just mention on that, which is funny, is, you know, I don't have quite the privilege that Benji does to base as much of my decision on my enjoyment of working with people. You know, my LPs are paying me to make the best investments. And if I have to deal with someone who's unpleasant, that's, you know, what I'm being paid to do. But with that said, what I find interestingly is that actually all of these things are the same. Investing in companies that I am uniquely positioned to evaluate, investing in companies where me and the founder view the world the same way and will be rowing the boat in the same direction, those are actually, for me, over the long term, the profit maximizing, ROI maximizing ways to invest. And I bet if Benji looked through his profile, his portfolio right now, the five companies he genuinely enjoys working with the most are probably the five that are also the best financial performers. And I'm not saying his enjoyment is rooted in the financial performance, but I think in an underlying manner, those things end up being more inextricably linked. And so all of those things that Benji said, I almost don't even consider some of them softer. I think they actually over the long term are part of ROI maximization, and that I would urge founders to keep all of these things in mind, not just with angels, you know, but with VCs as well.
There might be some overlap as well in running a successful company and also being a happy and approachable person while doing so. So we'll leave it at that, guys. We are past bedtime here at the Vested Interest podcast today. Long episode today. It's been super interesting to hear your feedback and insights. We're going to take a little bit of a Christmas break here amongst the team. We'll be back in January. So want to wish everyone a Merry Christmas and happy holidays, and to you and to Lloyd and Benji as well. Enjoy the holidays, guys, and we'll see you here next year.
Yeah, happy holidays.
Thanks, guys. Happy holidays.